The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Nutrien Ag Solutions, offering unparalleled access to high-performance inputs, innovative technologies, and local agronomic expertise to help growers lead the field. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McRae. Paul Niefer is one of our most popular guests, and he provides great info to help us prepare for tax season and make wise economic decisions. He's our guest in the first half of this show, and in the second half, we talk about when farmers are buying seed. Is there a difference in the age of farmer and what seed company they use? Listen and get tips on purchasing seed for 2020. It's all next on Farming the Countryside. I'll let you in on some background information about our podcast. Our next guest gets the most downloads of just about anyone we interview. Not only does he provide great info, but it's important to plan ahead when it comes to taxes and making the best economic decisions for your farm now and in the future. Here's Paul Niefer with Clifton Larson Allen.
Paul, I've got to tell you, I don't think you know this, but the podcast that we do, your podcast is always, if not the top, it's certainly in like the top three most downloaded podcasts. So people want to know about taxation, I guess, and I don't know if I should say how to get around it, but how to deal with it, because everybody's got to deal with it. But first of all, just tell me what's been going on out your way. You're out there in Washington State. How's the year been?
Yeah, actually, the wheat harvest out here is all done. The chickpeas and some of those chickpeas, garbanzos, hummus, whatever you want to call it, that's a big crop for us out here. They actually got delayed. I think they're finally done. The potato harvest is underway. Matter of fact, I was driving in early this morning. I'm an early bird. I think I was driving by a field where they were harvesting sweet corn at about 4:30 in the morning. So that harvest is going on. I would say crops this year are average, maybe a little bit above average. We are sort of like the Midwest. We got a fair amount of rain early in the season, back in, let's say, March, April, that time frame. So everything was delayed about a month. But Mother Nature, I think, has cooperated, and we're looking at pretty good crops.
Good, good. That's certainly good to hear. Well, let's jump into several of these tax topics here. And I'm looking at one of your latest articles. I don't know if it's going to be the complete latest, because you're always got new articles on Ag Web here. But let's talk depreciation. There were some changes in the most recent tax bill. So let's talk about then how those have changed and how that affects farmers heading into the end of this year.
Yeah, you know, the key thing is that under the old rules, farmers, when they purchased piece of equipment, they could take 50% bonus depreciation, but it had to be new equipment, or they could take Section 179, which is that one-time write-off on equipment, up to $500,000. The new tax law says now farmers have what's called 100% bonus depreciation, and it applies to both new and used equipment. So, and it's not just equipment, it's any farm asset that's depreciable is now qualifies for 100% bonus depreciation, and Section 179 is all the way up to $1,020,000 for 2019. Now, a lot of farmers would say, hey, that's great, wonderful news, but what happens, you know, I'm financing this equipment over a 7-year or 5-year period. I take all that depreciation up front, and then the next 6 or 7 years as I'm making those payments, I don't have any deduction. Well, the farmer is allowed to elect out of bonus depreciation, and that's on a class life by class life basis, essentially. So if you have a 5-year asset, you could elect out of that. If you have a 20-year asset, you could elect out of that. So what we try to do, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit later on, we don't really want to show losses if we can, because those aren't really good under the new rules. So what we want to do is go ahead and have our farmer come down to optimal income. So likely what we'll do is we elect out a bonus depreciation, and then we use Section 179 to bring our income, taxable income, down to where we want it to be. Because there's no reason to show a loss. We're losing the advantage of the 10% tax bracket. We're losing our itemized deductions or our standard deduction. We're losing some of those child tax credits. So there's no reason to ever have a loss if the farmer can help it. And certainly with depreciation, we have lots of options there.
I want to get over to those losses in just a moment. Just like you mentioned there, I do want to, on this topic of tax or depreciation here, you mentioned that certainly we focus a lot on the tax depreciation, how that affects our taxes, but not to forget the book depreciation, if you will, and the economic depreciation, because when you lose sight of that, you may lose sight of what's really going on in your farm operation.
Yeah, and especially for a lot of our top producers out there, they're typically providing some type of financial statement to a financial institution. And in that situation, you never want to use tax depreciation, because if you got 100% bonus depreciation on $3 million of assets, your equity is now dropped by $3 million, and that's not representative of what that equipment or what that fixed asset is worth. So when we're dealing with what we call financial depreciation, typically that's going to be on a straight line basis. You know, if a piece of farm equipment is a 5-year for the tax return, it might be 10 years for financial statement purposes, because that equipment these days, it lasts at least 10 years. There might be some salvage value. So that would be what we call financial depreciation. We want those books to look accurate. And then when I talk about economic depreciation, and Chris Barron is a columnist for Top Producer also. He and I have talked this over. And in that situation, a lot of times what we like to do is have a fair market value on your equipment at the beginning of the year. Get that from your John Deere dealership or Case IH or somebody that you trust that can give you a pretty accurate number. And then look at your value at the end of the year. And whatever that difference is sort of your economic depreciation. And then you have to sort of sit there and say, hey, is it really plus or minus that number? Because maybe you got an outmoded piece of equipment that you really need to upgrade to a new piece of equipment. So maybe there's a little bit more of economic depreciation there that might not otherwise be self-evident when you just take a look at beginning and ending.
Before we leave the topic of depreciation here, any other changes in the laws for this year, and also any other things just that we need to be aware of in general about depreciation here in the last quarter?
You know, there was a couple minor things. It was actually on the 18 tax return. This is now 19, but we're still sort of dealing with it. New farm equipment is actually depreciated over 5 years if you don't take bonus or take Section 179. Whereas used equipment, grain bins, fences, other types of land improvements still remain at 7 years. So that's a little bit of a minor change, 5 on new, 7 on used. And then farmers clear back in the 1986 farm, or the original tax reform of 1986 when President Reagan was in office, they switched everything to what we call double declining balanced depreciation, 200% declining. That's a situation where farmers get to deduct twice the straight line method in the first few years, then it gets a lot lower in the last few years. Well, back in 87, because of some other changes, they changed that to what was called 150% declining balance. Well, now it's back to 200%, just like all other taxpayers. So those are the two minor things that I would say on depreciation. But another topic that's probably close to it is Section 1031 exchanges. When farmers trade in farm equipment, under the old law, that was sort of ignored. You know, we didn't have a gain. We didn't get to pick up that as a deduction on the trade-in value. Now, under the new law, farmers have to recognize that as taxable income, but then they get to take bonus on the new piece of equipment. So it's likely, at least through 2022, when we still have 100% bonus, maybe not a big deal for those farmers in states that have no in-state income tax or follow the federal rules. But many of the key farm states, California, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, and so on, they don't follow federal law, so they don't allow bonus depreciation, and they don't allow much in the way of Section 179, many cases $25,000. So those farmers may get penalized on the state side. So that's something just to be cognizant of.
Good. Earlier on, you mentioned about showing losses on your tax returns, and I did want to get to that. In fact, it's a conversation we've been having here on our farm right now about, okay, what, as we head into this year, certainly we sometimes have some flexibility in how we are going to manage that tax return, if you will. So what about showing losses on my tax return? None of us like to pay taxes, but paying taxes does mean that you've made money, and I guess it's good if you make money. So how should I look at this as I head into the final quarter?
Well, under the new law, let's back up a second. Under the old law, farmers could carry back any loss 5 years, up to 5 years, and get refunds of taxes that they'd paid 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, et cetera. New tax law says now you can only go back 2 years. The maximum loss you can carry back is if you're single is 255, if you're married it's 510,000, and you can only offset 80% of taxable income. So with those restrictions, you know, doing a carry back really doesn't help us that much. Carrying it forward means we can only offset 80% of taxable income. That doesn't allow us to optimize it. So farmers now, a lot of farmers, you know, they harvest the crop in 2019 in the fall, but they don't sell any of it until 2020. And what they might do is, let's say they might sell some of it this year, but they do what's called a deferred payment contract where the money's going to show up on January 2nd or January 3rd of next year. We can always bring that income on those contracts, on 100% of each contract, into 2019. Couple more options. Farmers are also allowed to capitalize some or all of their repairs. And a lot of farmers have $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 of repairs. That increases your income. And then we can use Section 179 to bring the income down to the exact number we want it to be. So that's one option. So repairs, capitalize repairs. One is maybe sell grain into this year because you know you're going to have a loss no matter what. Reduce that loss. Or sell some of your grain on deferred payment contracts this year, lock in the price, and then go ahead and have it deferred into January. Then when we do the tax return, we can say, well, we need to bring in this contract or another contract. Also, farmers that put, let's say, fall fertilizer on, most everybody assumed that the normal deduction for fertilizer is that you just expense it. Well, under the tax code, technically, you're required to capitalize that fertilizer and then amortize it over the useful life. But all farmers are allowed to make an election to just deduct the fertilizer, and that election is just simply you deduct it on the return. You don't do a separate statement or anything. So if they apply fall fertilizer, really has no use this year. It's not really going to be used until you plant the crop next year. You could capitalize that fertilizer and then deduct it next year or over the next couple of years. So there are many, many options for our farmers even after the tax, even after year end. I mean, the financial statements are done, the QuickBooks is all updated, and now we're showing a loss of $100,000. For most of our farmers, between repairs and capitalizing fertilizer and maybe those deferred payment contracts, we can easily get that income up to, you know, maybe we want to show $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 of income so we can pick up child tax credits at the full $2,000 per kid. We can take advantage of that 10% bracket, which is probably the lowest tax rate we're ever going to have. Might as well pay some of that now versus kicking, you know, paying tax down the road at a 35% rate or higher. So when farmers retire, so that's a lot of the planning opportunity. There's many options. I just went through probably the three biggest options.
Let's take the kind of the flip side of that. For some farmers, they may have income and they want to reduce that through prepay, and that's common with a lot of farms. What do I need to be aware of if I'm trying to prepay some expenses heading into the end of the year?
You know, and that's a subject that when I do my tax classes for CPAs around the country, we always sort of discuss this a little bit. I mean, the technical rules are that, you know, a prepay really needs to be a purchase of a farm input item. It can't simply be a deposit at the local input dealership. You know, they need to be buying, you know, 3,000 gallons of diesel, need to be buying, you know, 162 gallons of gleam or whatever it might be, prepaying for the seed. You know, and that's the easy one. Typically, you know, Pioneer or DeKalb or whoever it might be has their own program. So those are the easy ones, but certainly diesel and those other farm inputs, chemicals, fertilizer, they're a little bit tougher. And then the other thing too is normally you can't prepay more than 50% of your non-prepaid items. So you add up all your other costs that are on your tax return, including depreciation. So typically that's not a big deal, but there's a revenue ruling. It's 40 years old now. It was back in 1979, 79225, that sort of goes through what are the rules for prepaid farm expenses. And those are, you know, it's got to be for an actual item. It can't be a deposit. You technically can't have right of substitution. You can't have a right to refund. And so I am a little concerned on a technical answer, not maybe a practical answer, is a lot of those farmers that had prevent plant and weren't able to use those inputs, a lot of those went back to the input dealership and got a refund. Well, technically, that likely might not have been a prepaid farm expense that should have been deducted on the 2018 return. Now, is anybody going to file an amended return on that? Likely not. And also, is the IRS going to care too much? I mean, it's a one-year timing. It's not an extra deduction. I mean, I think that's what IRS really cares about, is extra deductions, not necessarily a timing of a deduction.
All right. Good information. I want to jump over to taxes on payments, because certainly several farmers are going to have payments that they've received, crop insurance, MFP, so forth. What do I need to be aware of on that topic?
Yeah, on the MFP payment, I think people are starting to understand. Most of them have signed up for it. I get questions all the time. Can we defer MFP payments because they think it's like disaster aid or if it's like crop insurance? These are not payments for disasters. They're not payments for crop insurance or damage to the crop. That is the key on deferring any crop insurance. It has to be for damage to the crop. This was strictly payments related to tariff issues, price issues, so those can't be deferred. Now, on the crop insurance side, it's sort of interesting. The IRS and their publication 225 has come out several years ago, although we disagree with it, but several years ago, they said any payments that you receive on crop insurance related to revenue protection policies, none of those can be deferred. Now, we disagree. We think anything related to actual damage, you know, hail, well, hail is a separate policy, but certainly a drought damage, other types of damage that really would have caused you to collect a payment related to that damage to crop, that's deferrable. Remember, anything related to price damage can't be deferred. And then also on crop insurance, the farmer typically has to have a history of whatever crop they receive payments on, and it could be corn and soybeans, but they have to look at those crops that they receive payments on, and then their history for those crops, not necessarily all their crops, but for those crops that they get crop insurance payments on, their history has to be that they report at least 50% of their revenue in the year after harvest. So those rules can get a little bit tricky. I think this year, likely, I don't think we're going to see much crop insurance proceeds related to price. I mean, I think we're starting that right now, and I think the final harvest price, I don't think is going to be substantially different from discovery price and so on. So certainly most of it would probably be related to damage. And again, prevent plant automatically qualifies as crop insurance. So prevent plant, assuming their history is that they typically defer more than 50% of the crop in the year after harvest, all of those prevent plant payments are going to qualify for the one-year deferral.
All right. I have a couple other topics before we run out of time. We were going to talk a bit about younger farmers and perhaps some things they need to be thinking about as far as refunds on their tax returns.
Yeah, you know, younger farmers, especially in today's environment, maybe they're going to show a loss and we're thinking, well, loss, they don't owe any tax. Well, they're also not going to get a refund. And they're also not going to qualify for any type of Social Security credit. So one thing that we as preparers can do to help out the farmer in that situation is we can elect what's called the optional self-employment tax method, that they'll end up paying in about almost $900 of self-employment tax. And farmers saying, well, Paul, why are you doing that? You're costing me money. Well, A, it's building up credits for credits of Social Security, which helps with disability if that ever happens, and also provides additional self-employment or Social Security proceeds when they retire. And secondly, if they have kids, and let's say they have two or three kids at home, that then qualifies the farmer for an earned income tax credit, depending on their overall situation. In many cases, that credit might be a couple thousand dollars. So net-net, they'll get a refund between $1,000 and $2,000. And then if their spouse helps out on the farm but doesn't get any type of wage from the farmer and doesn't work outside the farm, we can go ahead and actually have that farmer pay an appropriate wage to the spouse. That increases the the earned income tax credit. In many cases, it's going to increase or create some child tax credit. And if we, as long as we pay it in the form of what we call a commodity wage, so there's no payroll taxes associated with it, it's pretty easy for us to create a refund of seven, eight, if they have three or four kids, maybe closer to $10,000 without very little work by the farmer and not much work on our end. All they really have to do is meet with their advisor before year end. Hey, I think I'm going to be in a loss. My wife's, or typically the wife is not working. Well, let's back up. Not getting paid for work, as my wife continually got upset with her kids when they said she never worked a day in her married life because she took care of the kids and didn't get paid for it. Believe me, she worked. I mean, I would not trade right. shoes with her in a minute. But as far as making sure that he or she gets paid an appropriate wage, a commodity wage, we can create a very nice refund for those younger farmers. And, you know, $8,000 or $10,000 for a younger farmer with two or three kids at home, that's, in today's environment, that's important money. So it's something definitely that they need to take advantage of.
Paul, before we wind up here, I've got one more question for you, but I want to tell listeners to this podcast, feel free to shoot me messages because, you know, there's so many topics that you and I can discuss and we don't have time to work them all in. But I really do love to hear what is on people's mind because just as we've been visiting, I've been jotting down notes here that I need to follow up with you sometime on a future podcast because there's just so many things. But I want to give you a chance here before we wind up. Just in general, other things that are on your mind as a preparer right now that you think should be on our mind as producers before we finish up this year?
Well, I just want to reinforce, yes, I know times are a little bit tougher now. Certainly MFP has maybe helped out. But, you know, meet with your advisor. Try to make sure that you don't show losses. Losses from a tax standpoint, I'm not talking financial, but from a tax standpoint, really don't gain us anything. And in the future, they might even hurt us a little bit. So go ahead and try to have a strategy with your tax advisor that you're trying to optimize taxable income, not eliminate taxable income. We don't want to eliminate taxable income. We want to make sure that we report the correct amount of taxable income.
All right, very good. Thank you as always, Paul. I appreciate it.
No problem. I enjoy it.
Driving rains, unrelenting heat, ominous green skies. Whatever Mother Nature brings, it's no match for what you'll have thanks to Nutrien Ag Solutions, offering agronomic power, local expertise, and access to solutions to help you weather the storm, conquer today, and lead the field. Find your local crop consultant at NutrienAgSolutions.com. For the past couple of weeks, I've told you about our listener trip. We're headed to Hawaii February 3rd through 12th. We are once again with holiday vacations to see top sites like Pearl Harbor, coffee plantations, pineapple farms, Volcanoes National Park, and much more. This is a three-item trip with ag highlights, and I know you'd enjoy our group. Airfare, tours, hotels, and many meals are included. This trip is filling up, so there's still time to get in, but don't delay. For more information, just call 800-826-2266 or just click on the link at AmericanCountryside.com. You'll see the box on the right-hand side of the screen, and you can click to get our tour agenda and booking info. I hope you'll join us this February in Hawaii. Well, before we even began this year's harvest, we already had seed dealers visiting with us about buying seed for 2020. There's nothing wrong with that, and some have programs that offer early buying savings, financing, and other perks, of course. But it got me thinking about what is the best time to purchase seed and what you should consider beyond just the seed when you are making those decisions. Margie Eckelkamp just happened to pen an article for AgWeb on that very topic, so I got her on the phone to visit about what she's learned from her research, and at the end of the interview, she reveals something interesting. Is there a difference in the seed company we choose based on the age of the farmer? Here's our conversation.
Margie Eckelkamp joins me on the podcast here. Margie, I see a lot of your work all the time, but one title here caught my eye, How to Purchase Programs Change Seed Decisions. I'm going to let you tell people, first of all, how to find the article, but I want to dive into it because it's something that we're dealing with here on our farm right now, and it sure struck a chord with me.
Yeah, it's that time of year, Andrew, and thank you so much for having me on. Folks can find the article on agprofessional.com as well as agweb.com, And I had a great interaction with an independent ag retailer named Conrad Smith, who runs Smith Ag in West Central Illinois. And he actually had the question in his own mind and took to Twitter to find some answers. And in his words, you know, seed buying programs are getting more complex. And really what he wanted to drill down on is taking product performance, taking yield expectation out of the equation, what's the greatest influence on a farmer's seed purchase from these four options? And those would be early pay dates, equipment programs, chemical rebate tie-ins, and financing terms. And far and away, 84% total of the votes were either in the early pay dates or financing terms buckets. So definitely the financial aspect of these seed buying programs is most appealing to farmers.
I'm interested in your thoughts and your research you've done. I wonder if we're at the point now where even some of the performance of the seeds is trumped by some of these other things as well. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have a great yield and a good crop, but in some cases, it seems like that is even becoming even more important in some cases than, okay, they're fairly even, but I'm looking at the financing over here, the early pay date. That's more important to me at this point.
Yeah, and Andrew, I'd be curious too on y'all's experience on your farm and how you look at the seed purchase, because you know, so often you hear the mantra, it all starts with the seed, or it starts at the seed decision. And I think that's even more true now, in that especially when it comes to traded corn and traded seed products, as well as some of the things that you can layer on with seed treatments based on agronomic challenges, but so many decisions for your farm's entire crop year are contingent on that seed selection. And I think, you know, not only is the agronomic component getting a lot more complex, but these seed buying programs are adding a layer of complexity. And, you know, they're adding in factors and things that have to be met throughout the year for all of those parameters to come true and for you to get the maximum benefit of some of these buying programs. So it really seed is becoming, the seed conversation with your retailer or with your seed dealer is even more drawn out through the year because you're tied to that seed decision even longer throughout the year.
And some of your research shows that now, by far the majority of the seed decisions are made before December 1, it looks like, and even over 10% now before October 1. Is that right?
Yeah, so Farm Journal does an annual research study with farmers on their seed decision. And, you know, we did the same question in 2018 as we did in 2019, in which we asked, in what month do you make your seed purchase decisions? And I specifically parsed out that data to the data of what month do you make your final seed purchase decisions. And we did see a little bit higher of an uptick toward a later in the year for that final seed purchase decision between 2018 and 2019. Now, I think some of that is reflective of the harvest season and conditions that we had back in 2018, so the 2019 seed purchase decisions. So it'll be really interesting. You know, here we sit with harvest just starting, how the timing of this year's harvest will affect the timing of the final seed purchases for 2020.
You know, in your article, you bring out your conversation with Conrad, and I'm sure you've visited with others. Any takeaways from that on what they have seen change at the retail operation and any advice they pass along to farmers in order to be able to not only get the seed and the traits they want, but hopefully the best deal that makes sense for them?
Oh, absolutely, especially as we started to look at some of the seed quality concerns that really came to light with the growing season challenges we've had here in the States and what that might mean for 2020 seed supply. There was a lot of dialogue asking farmers to get with their seed vendor early to make sure that they get their first choice on every acre, or do the best they can to get first choices on every acre. Another interesting takeaway, too, that I would share from our Farm Journal research is a majority of the farmers that responded, and to this question, it was almost 600, we asked, how do you buy the majority of your seed? And 57% said a majority of their seed is coming from a farmer dealer. So I think in this conversation, too, that might be helpful as farmers are really seeing some of the challenges, and they can encourage their peers to have these discussions early. I'd also share, I'm talking with retailers about some of these seed buying programs, and they say, you know, in every one, there can be surprises for the farmer. So to really dig into the detail, again, on all those parameters, that full checklist of everything that needs to be met so you get the maximum benefit of that seed buying program.
And in my experience, some of them can be so complex, you really do need a good retailer that understands some of them. Otherwise, you get lost in the weeds pretty quickly on some of this.
Yeah, I think a great seed vendor is invaluable for so many reasons, and I'm sure you can share so many examples and anecdotes from your own farming experience.
Sure. Well, I was in a meeting yesterday, and that was what the conversation was. I mean, it was several of us farmers meeting with a couple of retailers, and that's what the discussion was, is all of us talking about, okay, this program works this way, and what do I need to think about with herbicides? And yeah, it can get very complicated very fast. You really do have to have some folks that you kind of trust to be able to look at several of those programs to give you some good advice, I think.
Right. I would also share, I was, before we were having this conversation today, I just went back through our Farm Journal research from this last year in regards to seed buying, and I found it interesting, and I honestly, Andrew, didn't realize we asked this question, but we asked farmers by their age what their preferred brand was, and I think maybe we have some perceptions of specific seed brands that might be marketed toward different age demographics, but our research shows that there was no difference in age by those individual brands, at least no significant difference. So I was really interested to find that out.
Interesting. Good stuff. Well, hey, if folks are looking for your information, AgWeb is where they're going to find a lot of what you're doing, correct?
AgWeb, and then also I'd encourage folks to go to agprofessional.com, as well as please connect with us on social media. On Twitter, we are at AgProfessional. Facebook, just search AgProfessional, and we would really look forward to connecting with you guys there.
Thank you, Margie. We'll visit with you soon once again.
Thanks, Andrew.
Before we conclude this edition of the show, I wanted to make you aware of an annual event from our friends at Tractor Supply. Here's Doug Burney, Extension Agent of 4-H Youth Development in Williamson County, Tennessee, as we discuss the 4-H Paper Clover campaign.
I'm visiting with Doug Burney, who is the 4-H Extension Agent in Williamson County, Tennessee. And Doug, I know this week is kind of a big week because it's the 4-H Paper Clover campaign at Tractor Supply. A lot of people are probably familiar with that, but if they aren't, just start out by describing what that program is, because it's been around for a few years now.
It has been around for a few years, and it is certainly an incredible help to any of the 4-H clubs, regardless of where they're located. 4-H is really highly dependent on partnership with organizations, especially like TSC, and community support in order to make funding available for the programs that we do with young people, giving them an opportunity to have hands-on experiences and hands-on learning opportunities. And so what Tractor Supply Company so graciously does is they make literally a paper clover available to their customers when they come in that they can purchase on their visit. And all of those funds, 100% of those funds, end up going to support the local chapters of the 4-H programs. And so the local money stays local and gets directed toward those clubs. Those funds, in turn, here in Williamson County, go a long way toward helping provide scholarships for camps, opportunities for kids who might not have otherwise be able to afford or have the opportunity to go to camp or to participate in various aspects of our programming. That those funds are directed in then and actually allow them to participate.
And as you mentioned, it is a huge help every year because it is going to local 4-H clubs and helping them do so much of what they do with students every year.
That is exactly right. And every 4-H club, regardless of where they're located, is really dependent on help like that and of that kind. And Tractor Supply has just really stepped up in a huge way, making this opportunity available to all of the folks. Many of their clientele may not have ever even heard of 4-H, but it gives an opportunity for us to explain to them the opportunities that 4-H provide for young people, the work that it does in helping prepare the next generation of workforce and helping build stronger communities by working in youth development. But many of the customers that come into the doors of TSC are very familiar with 4-H, perhaps have even, you know, been in 4-H themselves or had their young people go through 4-H, and they're eager to support, and it just provides an immediate opportunity for them to be able to do that, and one that's really pretty simple to participate in.
And I was going to say that it's very simple. Just walk into TSC and you can get that paper clover very easily.
That's exactly right.
Great, great. Well, I have two 4-H members myself, so I appreciate the program. It comes back and helps me, and it helps the folks that you work with as well. So it's a great program.
It is a fantastic program, and we are just indebted and very grateful for Tractor Supply in putting this emphasis on 4-H. I know they do it a couple of times out of the year, but it's always a great opportunity to let people know the good work that's happening in 4-H and the great products that are coming out of that in terms of the skills, the life skills that kids are developing in that program. And it's a wonderful opportunity for the community to get involved in directly helping kids right where they live.
Well, thank you, Doug, and I really appreciate you sharing about it.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of our show. I always appreciate your feedback and story ideas. Remember, you can follow Farming the Countryside on Facebook, and you can also catch my daily radio features, The American Countryside, on radio, on AmericanCountryside.com, and follow it on Facebook as well. Thanks for listening to Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast has been brought to you by Nutrien Ag Solutions, offering unparalleled access to high-performance inputs, innovative technologies, and local agronomic expertise to help growers lead the field.